You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Okay, we're going. We're on. We're still in the middle of section 110, right?
Yeah.
And we completed subsection 14 last time, and now we're on to an unnamed section, subsection, that starts with the phrase Hegel's concept of the idea, right?
Yep.
It's page 166. And I guess I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hegel's concept of the idea and the first possibility of a philosophical history of philosophy from its first end. In this concept, all essential determinations of the history of the idea are contained and originarily brought to completion. One, idea as appearing. Two, idea as the determination of the knowable, the actual as such. Three, idea as the universality of the concept. Four, idea represented in the representing, thinking of the absolute, Philo Augustine. Five, idea the cognized in the cogito me cogitare, self-consciousness, Descartes. Six, idea as perceptio, the representing that develops in phases unitarily with willing, perceptio and appetitus, Leibniz. Seven, idea as the unconditioned and the principle of rationality, Kant. Do you want to talk?
Sure. About? Yeah. So I think when he says in this concept, he means Hegel's concept of the idea. So in Hegel's concept of the idea, we have all essential determinations of the history of the idea. So apparently Hegel's concept of the idea is pretty inclusive, probably as the result of a philosophical history reaching its end, or one of its ends, I guess. So in a sense, I guess philosophy came to some kind of terminus here with Hegel's concept of the idea. And what we have are some qualifiers that talk about what Hegel's concept of the idea is. Idea as appearing. So ideas appear, which in a sense means they become present. Probably implies they come and then they pass away. Number two, idea as the determination of the knowable, the actual. So the idea is now linked with what is actual or true or knowable. So in order to know something, you have to have an idea of it. Idea as the universality of the concept. So again, we have this linkage of the word idea with the idea of form and look and essence. And so the concept is universalized in the idea of the idea. The idea, I would say, kind of hovers over or generalizes the concept. In a sense, you could say the concept is a unit of thought, and idea is the abstract form of that unit as it exists, I guess, in the realm of essential being. Idea represented in the representing, thinking of the absolute. So ideas come to be represented in our representational system. Idea is cognized in the I think of myself thinking, cogito me cogitare, self-consciousness. So self-consciousness cognizes the idea. The idea as a perceptio, or in a sense perception, the representing that develops in phases unitarily with willing. That's kind of nice. As we will, our representations develop in phases, and this is something that that Heidegger calls perceptio. The idea is a perception, and then we have the linkage between perceptio and appetitus. Appetitus. It sounds like a name in Shakespeare. Oh boy, here comes appetitus. But I think appetitus is probably, Latin for willing here, or desire. So perception and desire become linked. And idea as the unconditioned and the principle of rationality. So some people might be asking, why? Who cares? What is this? What is this game of distinguishing the idea, of talking about the idea? We all have ideas. We know what ideas are. Ideas are obviously just sort of elements of the mind. We all have them. In order to think about the world, we have to have an idea of it. But I think Heidegger is talking about something a little more structural or Platonic in a way. You know, he's pointing out that the architecture, the makeup of our mind, of our cognition, of our conceptuality, of our perception, of our understanding of how desire and mentation coordinate to develop as us over time, how our sense of what is actual, how our sense of universal truths, of representation, of self-consciousness, how all of these things have now become kind of footnotes in the presence of the idea, that the mental construct, and certainly in a sense the communal mental construct, has come to be a container in which all of our cognitions exist, and that's not necessarily necessary. Things don't have to be that way. That's not the way our architecture needs to be set up. That's not the way we need to understand the world. It's not necessary that our mind work that way, but that is how things have come to be. And so we understand now that the power of the idea is very, very dominant and very absolute, because of its subsumption of all these other cognitive and judgmental qualities and these understandings of what we are. And lastly, you know, I think that's it's a symbol or a symptom or a shakedown of what we might consider to be our faith-based consciousness in the new liberal order and the ongoing liberal order, and that we trust in the idea, we have faith in the idea that ideas persist, are worth fighting for, have substance, have presence, adhere us to the actual, are integral in how our perceptions and our desires link up. Of course, there are many other candidates for what could be going on when we are doing whatever we do in relation to what we believe the idea to be, but this understanding has come to be the predominant one. I think that's it.
Yeah.
And I think it's hopefully maybe it'd be worthwhile to talk a little bit later about what this predominance of the idea actually results in terms of social, political, psychological, spiritual, philosophical, epistemological existences.
I have thoughts on that already, but
maybe go ahead.
I feel like there are things said that carry as ideas or came through someone as an idea that then are, I guess, that makes them more easily transferred and absorbed by others. I'm just thinking in particular, we're talking again about blood pressure and pregnancy. And I just talked to a midwife who said, oh, well, you know, a third of preeclampsia cases happen before labor, a third are during labor, and a third happen after labor. And I did some investigation into that, and apparently that's a common thing that midwives say or are told, but in reality that's totally untrue. It's just the fact that often like a third are discovered during labor because they weren't discovered prior. But it doesn't mean that it became a thing during labor. And as I was thinking about that, it just got me thinking about just how many things are said about potential pathologies, potential health issues that I feel historically I am very quick to jump onto and be like, to believe it and to like apply it to myself. And I feel like that's an idea. I feel like it's like, cause it's appearing, it's making something present that isn't necessarily a truth, but then it gets transferred, it gets shared, and then it becomes sort of a I mean, when I heard that, I was like, oh gosh, I'm not giving birth at home. I don't trust that to me was immediately like, oh wow, I can't. A third of cases happen during labor. That's a lot. But then, yeah, in actually looking into it and breaking down this idea that was said, it was like actually nothing like what was actually said. Is that an example of...
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I think to like put it into the context of liberal, post-liberal, I mean, I think liberal would be that what you have here are, and I'm going to say that like, I think idea in this context can be synonymous with identity or generalized epistemological unit, you might say, cognitive shortcut for certainty.
Yeah. Oh, that's very, very well said.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, our world is rife with these things. Our liberal world is rife with these things. Our liberal conversation is rife with these things, where we not only sort of say things about what we create, groups of knowledge sets, groups of people, groups of ideas, groups of facts, groups of statistics, groups of data, groups of perceptions, groups of observations, groups of outcomes, groups of assumptions. We create just continually what I would call, again, like identities. X is Y, in a sense, right? And we bandy them about. We throw them about. We exchange them. And sort of accuracy be damned. And I think that's kind of, I mean, that's kind of what you're pointing at there, right? Is that there are these medical claims or these statistical pattern claims that are not true.
Yeah.
But they become true in the way we react to them. They become true in the way that insurance companies deal with them, medical professionals deal with them, the way, and we're kind of often forced to face them as true.
Yeah.
Because the system that we're living in and for some need, it holds them as true because it has to for some reason. And I think in post-liberal agenda, the goal is to actually, I would say almost instead of thought being a generator of these epistemological sets, false epistemological sets, instead of thought, instead of that being what thought is about, and I think that liberal thought is actually about that. Liberal thought is about the generation of convenient identities. I think post-liberal thinking is actually the practice of trying to see through those, get away from those, cognize apart from those, get out of those, do the work of particularizing, perceiving, constructing more genuine, bang-based assumptions about the world, right?
Yeah, totally.
And of course, I think like your example is really pertinent because we have a nexus of emotions and yes. concerns and fears and anxieties surrounding those things
yeah.
that are very instrumental in them becoming actuality. Their identities are literally generated by the anxiety that precedes them. So they become repositories of that anxiety, safeguards against that anxiety, generators of that anxiety. Like they're not a very good solution, but yet they live. They are the mind virus that lives, right?
Yeah.
And so post-liberalism also wants to break that connection between anxiety and identity. Break that thought bridge that brings the two together and creates liberal thought as a reproduction of these anxiety-created identities for the purpose of retail, compassion, self-defense, political opportunity, whatever they are, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of one of the things that's really exciting about being alive right now is that there is this new, I saw it today described as the death of expertise. Hmm. Death of journalism, right? Hmm. Death of curation, I would say. Hmm. Death of education. Hmm. These things have been seen through as liberal activist agencies, what we might also call here, you know, identity clusters, identity woke mind virus, these kind of things, right? And seeing through those things and trying to imagine a post-liberal world without those things where that kind of identitarian structure is no longer valid yeah. is exciting. And it's like in the case of what you're talking about with Priya Klein, I mean, how would you say that all? What is that all? Now that I've said all that,
yeah.
talk again about the whole preeclampsia experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty, I mean, it's sort of specific to my situation, which is I have white coat hypertension, so I get high blood pressure in clinic. And so the sort of primary, well, actually, yeah, so, and then there were just all these things said about it. I had it last time too. And it's just like thinking about all of the things that the doctors have said to me about why I should worry about having high blood pressure. I mean, I can literally list them off. It's like is very like a tape in my ear. And it also, I guess as you were talking, it also really made me think about the nature of intrusive thoughts as well, because they so jump, like you said, emotions, fears, and anxieties. Like they are, I feel like, a ball of those things. And that in worrying about them or taking them seriously, it turns it into an actuality. But that in actuality, if you can sort of pick it apart or not let the emotion and fear override, then you just see a different reality. So I guess in the case of the blood pressure, you know, someone says, well, if you have white coat hypertension, you're more likely, or you're classified as having chronic hypertension, so you're more likely to have preeclampsia.
So what do you say though about risks to the mother and the baby? I mean, of course, that's what the medical professionals are going to say is we're just being extra cautious. We're looking at trends, and we're trying to prevent any damage to the mother and the baby.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem in this situation is they refuse to discuss white coat hypertension as separate than chronic hypertension.
Yeah.
So I'm being talked about as someone who has chronic hypertension.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's contradictory because they don't prescribe what one would normally prescribe to someone who has chronic hypertension, which is medicine, because it's not chronic hypertension. Right. So it's being treated one way, but it being a different reality. I mean, I think...
So you're saying, in a sense, the paradigm doesn't have room for your specific case.
Yeah.
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 I also think it is very, like you just said, the health of the mother, the baby, even saying something like that is like, is a pull, you know, trying to say that they are looking out for the better of the health of the mother and baby. You know, that's an emotional, that's sort of an emotional statement, you know. But, you know, in the situation we were in last time, that meant they wanted to induce labor early, which, you know, and then it gets contradictory. You're like, well, is that good for the health of the mother and baby to? Mm-hmm. So it becomes weighing a lot of variables in a way we don't even know the answer to. Mm-hmm. But still that sort of like what feels like a misdiagnosis or at least a non-accurate diagnosis of what's actually going on and an inability to talk about what's actually going on just makes it frustrating. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that there's... I don't know if it was always this way. Like, I feel like... what we might consider to be like, let's call it 1950s America, is the phrase people kind of use, is that like, you trusted the doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But it seems very present, like contemporary. I think a lot of people are obviously going through a great deal of, maybe it's not distrust of doctors, but it's, feeling a little empowered to suggest a different route. Maybe that's because we all have Med MD or whatever it is. I don't know. Or we all have Grok and ChatGPT, and we can, you know, and where we have communities where we can talk to people, you know, who've gone through the same thing.
It's a very liberal idea to advocate for yourself in pregnancy. That's actually a very liberal idea.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what you're talking about. So, like, do your own research.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like, I think liberals have a reputation because of COVID for doing whatever the doctors say.
Right.
But I would put forward the idea that advocating for yourself during pregnancy is something that exists in both liberal and non-liberal women.
Yeah.
It's also a very common thing among, like,
yeah,
I don't know what to say, like the homeschooling Christian crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's a lot of different types of women who advocate for themselves in labor.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole like free birth community.
Yeah,
people
exactly.
who literally do it without midwives.
Right. And right. Like, and those people are like deadhead Republicans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Probably like, they're like way.
I mean, they're a mess.
They're an odd salad.
Yeah. But yeah, it is interesting how there's definitely a crossover, kind of an unexpected crossover there with, yeah. potentially super liberal, super Republican sides. I'm not sure I really answered your question, but I feel like I really I liked the, again, like that idea of how we turn, like I feel like when something has emotional weight, such as the health of the mother and baby, right? Something like that, like when something has that kind of emotional weight, it just feels very easy to like just do a cognitive shortcut for certainty, as you said, just try to be like, just to hook onto something and like sprint to it or land on it or something. So it is a, and it all comes from an idea, I guess. It all comes from making something exist that we, I don't know, that we're not sure exists, but then latching onto it because it has emotional weight and then making it a reality to react against.
That feels pretty liberal to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there are lots of ideas, but then when we have an emotional weight attached to an idea,
right,
it gains legitimacy and power. So it's not really its validity, but it's rather its emotionality or its link. It's link to a preferred form of self-consciousness. You know, I find that whole self-consciousness thing kind of interesting. Cogito me cogitare. You know, I think myself, you know, I think in a sense, right? I think to think me, I think me thinking, me is me thinking. Thinking is thinking me. You know, in that paradigm, in that paradise of self-consciousness, there's it feels like sort of in the liberal world now, it's there's a lot of kind of system preferences there, right? And there's a big menu in there, and self-consciousness has become an approach, a system of affirmations, an aerobics program, a community, a self-community, therapy, obviously, like how we think ourselves and what we are to think of ourselves. Is a real project for people. So self-consciousness is not really an immediate fact. It's a mediated fact. I do feel a little like maybe the movement to post-liberalism is a kind of a dismantling of that cogito me cogitare, or the dismantling of self-consciousness, or the understanding that self-consciousness is more immediate than we know, and that the attempt to make self-consciousness mediated, the degree to which we try to mediate self-consciousness is the degree to which we begin deceiving ourselves, and in a sense, giving to the idea what we should give to nature. What's that? There's a phrase like give to the church what you should give to God, or give to somebody what you should give to somebody else, right? Like, I don't know that there's a dirty little road or an infinite regress in self-consciousness if you start trying to make it about understanding the proper way to represent yourself and to be represented by others as a self.
That's
very liberal, but the post-liberal tries to break that representation obsession down and get rid of it and be a little more immediate in terms of one's self-consciousness, right?
Yeah. I'm just going back to what you said. I think that's very well said. And also just going back to what you said a little earlier, I feel like the emotional weight given to an idea is what, gives it its weight and makes it reality. And I just, again, feel like that applies so much to intrusive thoughts. Because, like, if you had a thought you didn't like, if one had a thought they didn't like and just didn't care, then it doesn't matter. The whole reason it becomes an issue is because there's, like, a whole emotion, experience, upset with the fact that it's happened or it's there or could happen or might happen or could in some world maybe it would happen. And so...
Yeah, I mean, to what extent is liberalism training an emotional out of controlledness?
Yeah.
I mean, it really feels like it is sometimes.
I agree.
When I was growing up, it was definitely like there was this kind of agenda or this idea out there that the emotions were something that you were to indulge in, that you were to let guide you, that if you were doing anything with them other than just letting them out and letting them pull you like horses pull a chariot, then you were a self-deceived, repressed loser. Mm-hmm. And so it was this, you know, speaking, I don't know why we're talking about 50s America now, but, you know, it was kind of in reaction to the tight, repressed 50s America. And it was like, let's let our emotions out and let's let them gain control of us, or let's let them lead us. The emotions are to be released like the pus in a cyst, right? Like a big orgasm, like a big opening the floodgates, right? Like, it's really hydrodynamic metaphor, right? Like, the emotions... Mm-hmm. are to be released, and they are to pull us along. Mm-hmm. Like, let's slip the dogs of war. Mm-hmm. That's very liberal.
Yeah.
And it results in, as we've seen now, what you're talking about, is that reality or actuality or the idea or the link between perceptio and appetitus becomes what has emotional weight. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't have emotional weight, it doesn't exist.
Right, that's how something's valued or considered valid. Important to revisit or support or consider,
And it does seem like then the post-liberal perspective is that emotional weight ought not be on the scale. Mm-hmm. It can exist, and things do have emotional weight. They do cause emotions, and we have emotions, and those emotions can be released, but I think that the necessity or the prescription for wellness that releasing the emotions has become is called into question. Mm-hmm. And that there is actually a whole cluster of possible relationships that we can have with our emotions. Mm-hmm. But maybe there's one that we ought not to have, which is that it is the predeterminer of actuality. Mm-hmm. Because letting emotions determine fact seems a little biased against fact.
Yeah. Well, because then it just becomes what can cause the greatest emotion.
Yeah.
Which is what clickbait and the internet is run on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, why did you bring up the internet and clickbait?
Yeah,
life. Yeah, everything is run on that, right?
Yeah, but you're right. Yes, everything is. Yes, I mean,
I think. Yeah, so your point is, yeah. I mean. I mean, look, the internet and clickbait, that's theater, man.
Yeah.
Theater is emotion.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, although I would say there's actually, in a sense, two types of theatrical emotion. One is the emotion of conformity, and the other is the emotion of purgation. So one emotion is conjured in the audience in order to create a homogeneous community, and the other is to purge the emotions, depending on whatever the individual calls those emotions. So, and I would call the first liberal and the second post-liberal. But I mean, there's something there about how emotion guides fact.
Yeah.
I mean, fact without emotion, some people, probably a good number of liberals would say, is irrelevant, because it's only the emotion that the facts generate that give the facts any weight. Mm-hmm. Facts without emotion are weightless, abstract, irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Anyhow.
Yeah.
All right, well, why don't we read on?
8. All these determinations are originarily unified in the essence of self-mediating absolute knowledge, which knows itself as the completion not only of every form of consciousness, but even of all previous philosophy.
Yeah, he kind of just said what I said about self-consciousness, didn't he?
Yeah.
9.
From a philosophical point of view, what comes after Hegel is entirely deterioration and a relapse into positivism and life philosophy or scholastic ontology. And from a scientific point of view, it is the diffusion and rectification of many cognitions regarding the idea and its history. Even in this learned consideration, however, Hegelian points of you are still always operative, although they are often scarcely recognizable and are unable to make explicit their power to influence metaphysics. It is from these obscure sources that contemporary philosophy draws its concepts of idea.
Yeah, which is really just to say that, you know, after Hegel, everything is just kind of liberal worldview. That doesn't really ever take to task the way that the universal idea operates and oversees all forms of cognition and perception and desire, which in a sense is what I think, you know, when we talk about post-liberal, I think we're talking about what this book is trying to point us to, because I think what Heidegger is trying to do here is chart a course to the post-liberal, which would be to start to develop thought and philosophy outside of Hegel's or beyond Hegel's idea of the idea. Yeah, go ahead.
10. Since with this founding of the idea as the actuality of the actual, Hegel gathered the entire earlier, even pre-Platonic, history of philosophy into an affiliation. And since he conceived of such knowledge in its phases and their sequence as absolute self-knowledge, he thus came into possession of a necessity arising out of the essence of beingness, idea, a necessity according to which the phases of the history of the ideas had to form themselves into those phases.
Yeah, why don't you finish this section? Okay. In other words,
Hegel's history of philosophy, seen in terms of his way of questioning, was the first philosophical history of philosophy, the first appropriate interrogation of history, but also the last and last possible interrogation of that kind. On the whole, what has followed has been important scholarship, but basically, i.e. philosophically, it amounts to helpless and distracted blather whose unity derives only from the succession of the philosophers and of their writings or problems.
Okay. So what comes after Hegel is, as he says, a deterioration and a relapse into positivism and life philosophy, or scholastic ontology, which would be is probably what Heidegger might consider to be analytic philosophy, a bunch of professors sitting around talking about logic. Hegelian points of view are present in what everyone considers to be concepts and ideas. Since with this founding of the idea as the actuality of the actual, Hegel gathered the entire earlier history of philosophy into an affiliation. So in a way, Hegel is just sort of the crowning jewel or the ultimate conclusion of this whole history of the planting of the idea as the form that determines being. And since he conceived of such knowledge in its phases and their sequence as absolute self-knowledge, he thus came into possession of a necessity arising out of the essence of beingness, a necessity according to which the phases of the history of the ideas had to form themselves into those phases. Yeah, so this talk of phases, well, he then goes on to talk about how Hegel was a historian or created philosophical history. That's what he's talking about here, is that Hegel developed the idea of the idea by sort of following it through its various phases and sequences through the course of history, philosophical history, and bringing it up to the point of absolute self-knowledge. So he was, in a sense, someone doing a kind of an archaeology or a psychoanalysis of philosophy and concluding with this idea of absolute self-knowledge. It's just sort of what I was talking about with the cogito, me cogitare, and self-consciousness, and the way the liberal world now views absolute self-knowledge. The self is something we know. We must grow to know the self. We can have absolute knowledge of ourself. Our relationship with ourself is sacred. It's profound. It's sacrosanct. It's, how should we say, even hermetic. It's a right. It's a political right. It's a political action. The self and identity, which, you know, again, I'm not sure we have selves anymore. I think we just have identities. But the identity is absolute self-knowledge. One is in complete control of one's identity. One is, in a sense, a reflection of one's absolute identity. One's the idea of one's identity guides one. One is just kind of a puppet on the string of one's identity. And this is all, in a sense, as Heidegger is saying, this is all just basically liberalism's deterioration or manifestation of the Hegelian idea. And obviously, post-liberalism would be looking to step out of this absolute self-knowledge, step out of these the idea as the actuality of the actual. And so, I would say, let me kind of branch out, and then I'd love to hear what you think. But I mean, I've been thinking the last couple of days about the death of theater, about how liberalism killed the theater, and I have a variety of reasons as to why, but I think he's pointing to one of them here, and that absolute self-knowledge, absolute identity, the idea of the person being what the person is, identity being a group formation that becomes not only personalized but politicized, really comes in like a typhoon and kind of erases the theatrical festivities, anarchies, and frivolities of this of the non-identitarian self, the liberated self. Mm-hmm. And theater becomes impossible because action needs to be, by action I really mean intention, needs to be a war for greater absolute self-knowledge. Mm. And the idea of being a character is fairly repugnant to contemporary liberals. Being free and malleable and playful with oneself is dangerous and anxiety producing and also just not helpful to one's social and political goals. And so of course and of course theater now has to serve social political goals. And I would say, you know, I could say it should not serve personal goals, but of course the personal is political now, so there's really no personal outside the political, and so theater, which is supposed to be ultimately personal, is actually just foolishly political. So that's one way that the theater has kind of been destroyed, and I mean Heidegger is obviously interestingly pointing to it here, and I think that the post-liberal is an attempt to rescue theater from these invasive Puritans, libertine Puritans, you might call them.
emotional Puritans.
Yeah, emotional Puritans. But I don't know, the death of the theater and how liberalism killed theater and how post-liberalism might be able to revive theater has been on my mind lately.
Yeah,
but
just and art, think about. Obviously.
I mean, obviously art, yeah, of course. I mean, art is just visual theater, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so... the politically in favor artist now is just kind of like the new royalty, right? I mean,
yeah.
Mom Donnie's wife, we were talking about her today, and her political art is probably the biggest thing since Warhol, you know, I'd imagine.
I agree.
She has 1.2 million Instagram followers. I mean, she is going to be the biggest thing since Warhol. That's going to be my little prediction here made in November 2025.
Yeah.
Or Basquiat, maybe.
Yeah.
She's sort of a Basquiat, female Basquiat. I mean, it's not like her art is, it's strangely Basquiat-ish. I mean, in a certain way.
Oh yeah.
It's not of Basquiat's level, but I just can see comparisons being, Warhol, Basquiat kind of. But again, she's kind of just a doodler, to be honest. Her work is just basically doodling. But it's just so spot on. And, you know, it uses the iconography of Arabic, which I'm sure just sends liberals into the bathroom to do another line of coke and touch themselves in the privates. I mean, they're probably just literally going batshit loony for this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big thing. And it's because she just has landed at a political moment with some iconography that makes people drool into their newly cracked open Qurans, because it's now the new wave of religio revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anyhow,
yeah,
it was kind of a detour and kind of what the whole show is about. But what do you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This isn't much, but I was just scrolling on Instagram earlier and just like, I feel like I haven't seen a good piece of art in a really long time. I often scroll on Instagram. I'm like, I just want to like see some good art. Like I used to like be sort of inspired by things I saw, and either I'm just bitter or it is all pretty like dismal, but like, I don't know. It's hard to even imagine what would be outside of the structure of what currently is, how you would recognize it, how you can find it, and what it would be. I don't even know what it would be. I mean, I think probably like I'm sort of trying to make it, but myself, right? Like I think we're probably both engaged in a process of trying to make work that we consider to be outside of politics, outside of identity somewhat, but I don't know how I would recognize it in someone else. I don't know how I would see it. I don't know how I'd come across it. And like, we're not obviously the only ones doing it. People are doing it, but like, how do you even, I don't know. So again, not particularly insightful, but like, where is it?
Yeah. Well, you got to look. It's got to be out there. I think it's hard when you're finding everything through an algorithm designed to show you that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard. So, you know, I don't really know. I don't have an answer to that.
I guess perhaps the sort of question is like, well, what are the features that would make something not what you just described? Like, what would make something theatrical again? What would make something?
Yeah. Yeah. That, and I think that's the post-liberal art question.
Yeah.
Is, you know, I saw people talking the other day about sort of what's, since all art is left-wing, what's right-wing art? And I was kind of like, well, left-wing art, neither left-wing nor right-wing art are art.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that's the right way to think about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think if there's a post-liberal art, yeah, that's the question. I mean, first of all, I don't think we can really formulate what that's going to be. I think the only thing that makes great art is that it's absolutely surprising. And it comes out of something that you could never have conceived or foreseen or formulated or pre-programmed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just going to be a question of when we see it. We obviously are both very engaged in trying to make it. So, again, I think we're not very good judges of it, probably. I think artists are probably are chronically the worst judges of art. I think it very much behooves us to find all other art repulsive or all art extravagantly beautiful, right? They say mm-hmm. Picasso loved every painting he ever saw. I think getting to the point of loving every painting you ever saw is a definitely a noble cause. It can be hard. It's hard. Life is hard. Life is lonely. Life is oppressive. Definitely being an artist is hard and oppressive. But you know, I think, I mean, let's be fair. All we do is stare at our phones.
Yeah.
I mean, apparently you went to something a couple of weeks ago. Was it a print festival or something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did.
Right?
I went to a print festival, yes.
You went to a print festival. So you actually saw art in the wild?
Yes.
Wow. And was there any post-liberal art there?
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, there were a few things that caught your eye.
Yeah, like I said to you, it was the last booth. I've been intrigued by printmaking for a while, and I was surprising to myself, unimpressed by seeing so much work on paper. It felt a little drab, one dimensional. I mean, it was two dimensional generally. And a lot of like repeated images because they're often using prints. But literally the last booth I walked into, I was...
it's like a print collective.
It was a print collective out of Albuquerque. Yeah. And it had some really just surprising...
Yeah, I imagine the print collective in Albuquerque being really super cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is. It was the best thing there.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was really fun about it was I guess each artist gives one work and then it's for sale, but it was actually the bin I was looking through was probably 100 different artists, and there were a few works in there that I was like, wow, these are good.
Well,
and I bought one.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
you found some post-liberal art.
Yeah,
right. So,
yeah,
what I want to say is I think that post-liberalism is extremely new.
Yeah.
And I think the idea that there would be post-liberal art is actually repulsive.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want post-liberal art. I don't want art that I can identify in any way.
Yeah.
I don't want art that I can link to any kind of philosophical movement, any kind of political shift, any kind of, you know, ideological gestalt. I don't want any of that shit. I, mm-hmm. I, you know, I sent a reel to a friend today. I thought it was hilarious. It was probably post liberal art, you know. It was like just like a funny shit on my phone. Like I see that stuff all the time, and it's like, I mean, I saw a Beeple the other day. I thought, oh, that's pretty fucking funny, you know. Like you know, I have flashes. I'm actually a pretty entertained person. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I am blown away by stuff like, wow, that's a magnanimous history breaking creator. But again, I'm somebody who thinks that for the entire 20th century, there were like, there was one great poet and maybe three that were okay. Mm-hmm. That's 100 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be sitting around for a while waiting, looking, searching. Yeah. And I'm sure you would agree. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I don't.
But at the same time, yes, we live in a murdered world.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, we live in a decimated, art allergic world.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it seems like it, yeah. I
mean, it does like seem it. Like it. And it's weird. I'm not sure I feel old saying that or I feel bitter because I'm not sure that's what it is. I think, again, I would say we're sitting here saying how did the church get all the artists?
Yeah.
I think that's the sensation we're having. And of course the answer is, well, the church pays for all the artists.
Yes.
The church actively destroyed the artists who would not join the church. Mm-hmm. And the church now has the power over showing all the art. Like, so all the art you see, because of, say, for instance, the algorithm, and because of just human decimation. I mean, it's hard to make art year after year after year after year after year after year if the church doesn't give you a couple shows.
Yeah.
Most people don't have the money to do that. You know, they don't have the time or the money, so they just die off.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's been a war of attrition against non-church art for a while. And also, you know, I think that now when art does step forth and become seen and become recognized and become lauded and become valued and become shown, it reeks of the church. Mm-hmm. And somehow we can't get out of that. Like, mm-hmm. somehow I think that's what we're sitting here at our microphones trying to figure out, is how a world outside the church that's not a church, mm-hmm. might be generated. Mm-hmm. And we don't know. And I think that when that world comes, we're not going to know it's coming or why it came, or hopefully it's not even a world. Like, mm-hmm. I think that Heidegger would say, it's important to remember, we're not here trying to repeat ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you're trying to create, it's not even create, like when you're trying to break out of language and system and ideology to like feel a little bit of fresh air, you just don't know where you're going. You don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
So you just fumble and stumble and rumble all day long with your thoughts and your stretchings and your reachings. And like somehow something gets going a little bit. But again, we're dealing with decades and decades and decades of time required. And art always comes from behind you, you know? Mm-hmm. And you spot little inklings of it, and you see a little, it's like the passing of the last god, right? You see a little bit of it on a mountain, and you run over and try to grab it, and then it's gone, and then, I don't know what I'm saying, but you know.
Yeah.
I also think that, you know, honestly, like I'm at this point now where I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be like the Ashbury of TikTok. That's like my new, that's like my new agenda, you know? So I'm combining these different, like I'm combining this very contemporary performance place with this very like old poet and my kind of like filtering. And I think that like with your art, with any artist, the most important thing is to make post-liberal art and just forge that forest forward.
Yeah.
And share and make and share and make and every day say, how can I make more post-liberal art? How can I really go farther in this thing? And and as always, then one day you look up and you have planted the forest you always wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And other seeds have blown in.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't these metaphors I'm making, they're just
really, they're amazing,
right? They're really breathtaking.
Yeah.
But let's get back to the topic at hand: Heidegger, art, idea.
Yeah.
Post-liberal. Anything to say there?
I mean, I feel like the wall text has destroyed art in terms of it always gives an idea, a story, a political message to an artwork. So instead of looking at a work and experiencing it based on whatever it is, everyone is supposed to come up with their why, with their story. That's great.
I'm really glad you brought that. I'm really glad you combined those two words, idea and story, together, because I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think that we could literally just transplant the word story in wherever we see idea in Heidegger, mm-hmm. and especially in terms of within the liberal context and the post-liberal shift, you know, that story is the overarching form of immediate self-consciousness and the construction of the completely pervasive liberal paradigm. It's story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But story is just an idea carried forward through time via structured and controlled phases, as mm-hmm. Heidegger says, mm-hmm. right? Story is just identity over time.
Yeah.
Story is identity over time.
That's nice. Yeah.
And maybe story has to be political. I don't know. I mean, what is the political? Maybe the political is just the storied. Maybe that's what politics are, is actually the hashing out of which stories shall predominate,
mm-hmm.
which stories are most justified, which stories are most principled, which stories mm-hmm. make humans happiest, mm-hmm. which stories are right, which stories are just, which stories deserve to exist, and which stories must be buried and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but I mean, I think there's something there when we hear the word idea, which is a little, you know, it's a little generic. What does it mean? What's an idea? Mm-hmm. But story is another thing. And, I mean, you know, you look at Mamdani's wife, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name, but you know, it's her story that really, her art would be nothing without its story.
Mm-hmm.
Can art be something without a story? I mean, and that's the thing. I think it can be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it can be.
Maybe that's part of what I liked about the sort of basket of
right.
all the different artists, is you didn't get a sense of a story because it was just like one or two works per person.
Right.
So instead of being like, oh, this person does this kind of bird.
Right. Well, there was no placards too, right?
Yeah.
They were just really floating there like flashes in the night, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a really important point, is that if it would be cool if post-liberalism could create a way in which art could be found and experienced free from story.
Yeah.
Again, I have no idea what that means and how that could happen, but that seems like a really important element. And of course, that means creating a world that one can experience that is not guided by story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that is. And I don't think even the word world is the right word for it, but you know, somehow where there could be unstoried, unpolitical art somehow that happens. And I don't know what it means by happens. I don't know what it means by it becoming present. It obviously, if it's going to be present without a story, it needs to be unstoried, or its story needs to not be a part of its projection, production, or its raison d'etre, or its visibility, or its promotability. It needs to be something different outside of this story system that art has become. Or the story support group that art has become, which is another thing. It's just like, I've probably said this 25 times on this damn podcast, but it's like, if I have to hear another artist tell me how important art is, you know, I'm going to start shitposting on X four times as often as I already do. You know, it's just like, I just can't take it anymore. That word important, that linked with art, just really so stinks of NGOs and art grants and the enforcement of the liberal order via a defunct creativity. It's terrible.
Yeah.
I saw this guy make a post. He said, I'm convinced that there are only three things we need to do now. One is in-person voting, except for cases of actual absenteeism. So there's, you know, get all the undocumented immigrants out and remove the nonprofit accreditation to NGOs and churches. Yeah. And in parentheses, he said, we have to do churches, otherwise they'll abuse it. Government arts funding has to stop. I mean, that's not even the right way to put it. I mean, because there's private fund. I mean, that's not right. I mean, that's why he concentrates on the idea of nonprofits, right?
Well, the way that politics has infiltrated, like, I mean, art institutions, a great example. Who would have thought art institutions would be taken over by politics, but they totally are. And they're getting tax write-offs, and you're like, well, why is that's a political right. entity that's getting right. a tax write-off? So
why are they getting a tax write-off? To fund political action.
Yeah, exactly.
When all art is now political action, I mean, you can't even buy a boosted post that has a mention of politics in it on the internet, but yet there's a $50 billion arts grant industry that's all of which is tax exempt that's funding political action called art.
That's true.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting, and that liberals find that legitimate. So post-liberalism has to decouple these forces, decouple the money, the politics, the nonprofit, the tax exempt, the non-governmental organizations that are actually just arms of the government, art becoming Social Security, you know, art becoming policymaking, art becoming political advocacy. All that needs to be decoupled. And maybe that's just really actually just restructurings and revolutions and reformations of deep state governmental funding systems. Maybe that's a start, you know, but I think also post-liberalism just needs to really, if anybody is interested in post-liberalism, they need to really go at this idea of art being important because it's liberal. I also think, as somebody who just operated in the New York theater scene for so long and is now operating in this kind of insane free market likes-based performance world, I don't know. It's like we're living in the death throes of the the death throes of funded art. Because funded art is about the artists indulging their what are now basically just political goals. Mm-hmm. Free market art is about doing stuff that people want to see. And having lived both realities, I'll tell you, like, they are completely different. Like, they're not even the same industry. They're not even the same intention. They're not even the same consciousness. They're not even the same praxis. They don't even have the same objectives. They're just completely different things. And you know, just trying to make art that people want to see is the hardest and most interesting thing there is, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm babbling.
No, that's.
Like, I think that all goes back to me for that. All this goes back to the idea of the idea. There is an idea of everything now. Everything. We have an idea of everything. We have an idea of art, right? We have an idea of NGOs being important, right? I saw Ken Burns talking on X today about how NPR and PBS need to exist, otherwise rural Americans will not have any news. They'll live in news deserts. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And, you know, the joke that everybody commented was, apparently Ken Burns has not heard of the internet. And you know, people are like, boy, yeah, we're living out here in the sticks. We ain't even heard it. And nobody, one guy said something like, my family learned in 1973 that World War II had ended, you know. Like news deserts. I mean, that's just hilarious. Yeah. So we have this idea of NPR. We have this idea of PBS.
Yeah.
We have this idea of rural people. We have this idea of news deserts.
Yeah.
We have this idea of things being important and valued. And those ideas die hard because we have put them on life support. So it's all these ideas that govern us and control us and guide our judgments. Post-liberalism seeks judgment free from the life-supported idea, if that's possible. And again, I don't even know if anything that I reference as post-liberal is possible, but it is all basically trying to escape these liberalized forms of life that need constant life support via the extraction of other people's resources. Really, you know?
Yeah.
And via the homogenized, important community that has to be incessantly supported and bolstered and propagandized in order to keep the whole thing working.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing is huge and everybody's got to chip in and everybody's got to be on board.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not going to work anymore, which is why art is all about just kind of contributing to the whole thing working.
Right.
Because people are scared shitless that the whole thing might not work. And even artists who are supposed to not give a rat's ass about that stuff now are basically building, you know, extra floor beams to hold the thing up.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is something to say?
Not really.
All right.
I think that's good.
All right. Good night.
Yeah, good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.